His dad was King of England, or at least sort of. That being the case, how does a usurper's son create legitimacy? This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and this is the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast. After the death of Henry IV of England, Prince Hal, as everyone has been calling him, has a plan to establish himself on the throne, despite his shaky claim to that crown. At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought in June, Dr. Glenn Arbery, president of Wyoming Catholic College, explained how Shakespeare told the tale of Prince Hal in the play Henry V. Here are Dr. Arbery's remarks in their entirety.
I am speaking this afternoon in unusual trepidation because Father James is here. And Father James knows history so thoroughly that anything I say is going to be set against the backdrop of what actually happened. So let's just say at the outset that Shakespeare is a poet, not a historian. How about that? Well, you know, in my estimation, Father, the actual history of England was just a, you know, decent introduction to Shakespeare. History exists in order to be made into poetry, you know. That's the real point of it. But I want to do a couple of things this afternoon. And one of them is to think about our topic, courage, and its relation to speech or rhetoric, because we're going to be coming back and kind of focusing a good deal on probably the most famous speech in Shakespeare, you know, at least having to do with courage or having to do with this particular dimension of things that we've been discussing. And that's the St. Crispin's Day speech that Henry V makes just before the Battle of Agincourt in 1415. So we're going to read that speech closely a little bit later and try to see what Shakespeare is showing us, what kind of courage it is, in the senses that Kyle Washit's been, you know, laying out for us. But before we get there, I want to put the St. Crispin's Day speech into the context that it has in Shakespeare, which is very complicated. And you have to bear with me for a while here. This is the fourth play in a tetralogy. So it's called Shakespeare's Second Tetralogy. It begins with Richard II, goes through Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, and then ends with Henry V. It's called the Second Tetralogy because earlier in his career, he had written four plays centering on the War of the Roses that begins with Henry VI, who was made king after the death of Henry V. He was still a child. So three plays called Henry VI, parts 1, 2, and 3. How's that? And then the final play of that tetralogy is Richard III, which probably is what most people read if they read any from that sequence. If you just read Richard III, you're going to be bad off in the sense of understanding where these things come from. Similarly, I would suggest that if you just read Henry V, you're not going to get the whole flow of what it is that Shakespeare intends here. You can certainly read it alone, but it's going to change something of your perspective on what's going on. Let me just give you an example. All right, if you looked on page 2 of your handout, in the right-hand column, Canterbury and Ely, both bishops, are discussing, I think, in fact, it's the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bishop of Ely, but they're discussing the new king. So Canterbury, the king is full of grace and fair regard, Ely, and a true lover of the Holy Church. Canterbury, the courses of his youth promised it not. The breath no sooner left his father's body, but that his wildness, mortified in him, seemed to die too. Yea, at that very moment, consideration, like an angel, came and whipped the offending Adam out of him, leaving his body as a paradise to envelop and contain celestial spirits. Never was such a sudden scholar made. Never came reformation in a flood with such a heady currents, scouring faults. nor never hydra-headed willfulness so soon did lose his seat and all at once as in this king. Ely, we are blessed in the change, and so on. So your picture, right, of Henry V is that this is somebody who, as soon as he became king, just, you know, emerged as this figure of great intelligence, great learning, everything, you know, just all at once. So that could easily be our picture of what Henry V is. It's considerably more complicated if you look back into the earlier plays. So let me sort of take you through this. And what I'd like to suggest is that what we're looking at is, in general, in moving from Richard II to Henry V, is a shift from sacramental kingship to what I want to call charismatic kingship. And let me try to explain what I mean. Richard II is indisputably the legitimate king of England. Edward III, great king of England, all right, lived to 1377, I believe. His first son was known as Edward the Black Prince. He predeceased his father by a year. So had he outlived his father, he would have been king of England. Edward III had many other sons. The next in line, still living after the Black Prince, was John of Gaunt, who is the father of Henry Bolingbroke. Got all this straight? Then you have others, but Richard II was the direct son of Edward the Black Prince. You've got all these claims going on. That one is complicated by the fact that there's a daughter in there, I believe. So, you know, how you figure the inheritance and so on. Extremely complicated situation. But it's not complicated to get from Edward III through Edward the Black Prince, who died, to Richard II, who is the son of the Black Prince. So when Black Prince dies and then King Edward III dies, Richard II becomes king, but he's still a child. When Richard II became king, in the sense of taking full responsibility, he was, let me put it this way, at least in Shakespeare's depiction of him, indisputably legitimate, indisputably a terrible king. He is pretty clearly responsible for the murder of his uncle Gloucester. He is having all kinds of riotous things going on in the palace, loose living, bad counselors, everybody around him kind of corrupt. And he's bankrupting England. He's, you know, selling off lands and, you know, taking over things. When he hears that John of Gaunt, Henry Hereford, who is the son of John of Gaunt, challenges this man named Thomas Mowbray. And it's very complex, but the whole issue is whether Richard II is responsible for the death of his uncle Gloucester or not. And in effect, John of Gaunt's son is accusing him through this other man, Thomas Mowbray. So they're having a trial by combat, and whoever wins, you know, will reveal something about the nature of the guilt there. Richard calls off the contest, banishes them both, Mowbray for life, and Harry Hereford for, 7 years, I believe. John of Gaunt gets his sentence reduced. But in any case, shortly after this, John of Gaunt sickens and is on point of death. That's where you get that famous Sceptred Isle speech that he gives in direct response to the way he sees Richard ruining England. When John of Gaunt dies, Richard seizes upon his lands, you know, for his own gain, and I think to help support his war in Ireland. And this is one of those things Machiavelli says you never do. You never take anybody's wife or mess with their inheritance, you know. So Henry Hereford, who's now Bolingbroke since his father died, is in France in exile. He comes back to England with, you know, a group of men who are going to help him get his inheritance back. As soon as he comes to England, the public acclaim for him is immense. Everybody in England is sort of flocking to Bolingbroke because they so much prefer him to the corrupt and frankly murderous, dishonest Richard, you know, who's just the worst king in the position it seems like that there could be. So Bolingbroke is sort of gathering up this whole force. Meanwhile, Richard comes back from Ireland to confront him. You know, he's coming back to make his claim as a legitimate king. And let's look at the speech that Richard gives when he returns. As soon as he gets there, it turns out that all the troops he had been expecting to support him have begun to vanish. Some of them because he didn't get there in time, you know, they waited for a while and then left, and others because they are disaffected. I think if we could just hold this speech sort of implicitly up against the St. Crispin's Day speech, you see some of the difference between what Richard assumes and what Henry V will assume. Kyle, can I get you to read this one?
When this thief, this traitor, Bolingbroke, who all this while hath reveled in the night, whilst we were wandering with the antipodes, shall see us rising in our throne, the east, his treasons will sit blushing in his face, not able to endure the sight of day, but self-affrighted tremble at his sin. Not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm off from an anointed king. The breath of worldly men cannot depose the deputy elected by the Lord. For every man that Bolingbroke hath pressed to lift shrewd steel against our golden crown, God for his Richard hath in heavenly pay a glorious angel. Then, if angels fight, weak men must fall. For heaven still guards the right.
So what's the argument here? He's the anointed king. He's God's elect, right? He's not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm, you know, from an anointed king. You can try, but I'll be king regardless, you know, of whatever is done. So notice, worldly men cannot depose. So as opposed to the divine, you know, office that he holds. Notice that shrewd steel, that kind of canny, you know, worldly wise steel against our golden crown, this thing that's sort of lifted above worldly strife in the holiness of it. But troop wise, what are we going to say here? What's he counting on?
Angels.
Yeah. So for every man that Bolingbroke has gotten to fight for him, God for his Richard hath in heavenly pay a glorious angel. Yeah. So it's sort of like he's in command of the heavenly host that he'll be bringing against Bolingbroke. If you're in the army listening to this speech, where are you? Right, maybe, you know, maybe there's some heavenly angel I'm not seeing here, you know. But notice the image of the sun there. An irony, where's Richard coming from?
Ireland,
which is on which side of England?
West.
Huh. And which side is Bolingbroke coming in on? From France. So it's sort of like I'm trying to wrench that image around to get Richard to be the sun rising in the east, but you know he's kind of tone deaf, so to speak, to his own metaphorical claims. Interesting image that we'll you know see again with Henry. Okay, are you familiar with what happens in the aftermath of this? Henry the Fourth. Well, Bolingbroke, almost against his will, I really just came to get my lands back, all right? He keeps saying to everybody. On the other hand, he has this army that's so much huger than Richard's that he can't help but I mean, what are you going to do? You've got all the power, and you're going to get the guy who took your land, and so what do you do with him? You put him back on the throne? Say, give him my land back?
I don't think so.
Yeah, you don't think so. So he, you know, almost by default becomes king. And yet, Richard II is indisputably, right, by right, the king of England, bad as he is. So what have we got? A situation in which the person who seems much more effective, much more popular, capable of being king, is unfortunately the one who is illegitimate. So he deposes Richard, sends Richard off to jail, and then in an unfortunate comment or something, says something about he wishes somebody would rid him of this problem. And one of his men takes that as a suggestion to go and kill Richard, which he does. So now, what are we looking at? Henry IV, having usurped the throne, has now killed the legitimate king, and lots of that popularity, you know, that bore him to the throne begins to fade away, because it's pretty clear that his claim to the throne is based on power, right? It's based on force rather than on any kind of right that comes to him from God.
And so, descendants, yeah, of the second son of Edward III are still around.
Yes, they are. Right. So, you know, you've got Glendower in Wales and all these people who begin to make the claims for Mortimer, who's the claimant from that side. Meanwhile, the men who helped Henry IV get to the throne are feeling like they haven't been given enough credit or enough land or whatever. So they also begin to work against Henry, and in collusion with Glendower, Mortimer, and the others who resent Henry's rise. So in the two plays that follow Richard II, we see constant civil war going on in England. And it's pretty clearly because Henry IV has no legitimate claim to the throne, and you know, so it becomes a matter of whether he can maintain it by force against those who are going against him. Now, some of the most famous characters from these plays emerge here. Hotspur is the son of Northumberland, one of the men who was instrumental in getting Henry back into England, you know, and getting him on the throne. And Sir John Falstaff will get to in just a minute. Where is the son of Henry IV? You know, doesn't he have a son? He's hanging around at the Lander Bar. You know, he's down at the Forge every other night. You know, he's this. Y'all know Sir John Falstaff. You know what I'm talking about. You probably got an image of him: big, fat, wry, drunkard. John Falstaff, extremely intelligent, but also extremely dissolute. His speech about honor, honor being a, what is that word, honor? Air, and so on. It just kind of completely deconstructs the whole idea of honor when he's confronted with it. But in any case, Hal is hanging around with Falstaff and other lowlifes in the London bars. They rob a group of people going to, I think they're going to Canterbury. It's interesting, because this would be almost exactly contemporary with the Canterbury Tales, you know, which Chaucer was writing at the time. I hadn't thought about that till right now. Anyway, Hal is hanging around with the lowlifes. As far as we know, he's just a bad son to a man who really needs a good son, particularly at this time. One of the things that Henry IV says is that he wishes Hotspur had been his son. You know, that's the kind of son he would want. So, meanwhile, when we get into the play, we begin to get a different picture of Prince Hal altogether. In fact, pretty much at the end of the first scene that's supposed to demonstrate his dissolution, we get this speech. So Falstaff, Hoynes, I forget who else is there, probably Bardolph. He's the drunkard with the red nose you can apparently light your way through the streets with at night. Anyway, they go back into the bar proper. And so this is the soliloquy, you know, that Prince Hal gives. Our first experience of him directly. I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humor of your idleness. Yet herein will I imitate the sun, who doth permit the base contagious clouds to smother up his beauty from the world, that when he please again to be himself, being wanted, he may be more wondered at by breaking through the foul and ugly mist of vapors that did seem to strangle him. Very interesting, isn't it, that he takes up the very same image that Richard II uses. If all the year were playing holidays, to sport would be as tedious as to work. But when they seldom come, they wished for come, and nothing pleaseth but rare accidents. So, when this loose behavior I throw off, and pay the debt I never promised it, by how much better than my word I am, by so much shall I falsify men's hopes, and like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation, glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men least think I will. Okay, so what is he saying? Is he really leading a dissolute life? Right, or is he kind of surrounding himself with the appearance of doing so in order, right, to make this effect more prominent later? I mean, he's interested clearly by his own words in the effect he's going to have. You know, my reformation, that's the same word the two churchmen will use later, right? My reformation, glittering o'er my fault. It's like a diamond you put up against a dark background, right? Oh, that's the foil, you know, it sets off the diamond. So show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. So if I were just the good boy, right? If I were just the good son, what would that get me, right? That's just the standard practice. He kind of is sacrificing his father in doing this. You see what I mean? He's not the good son, he's not supporting dad, he's off dissolute looking. So that, you know, he can prepare his own kingship, and he's got good reasons to do it this way, as I think we'll see. If he is the, you know, he's the heir of a usurping king, that doesn't look good, right? I mean, that's sort of two removes, you know, from legitimacy. But if he can refigure this in some way, which he seems to be doing from his youth, right? You know, before his father even falls ill, during the whole period of the Civil Wars, he's preparing what he needs to do. Now, in Henry V, the chorus is presenting us with the kind of, you know, all the way through the play, it seems to me, presenting us with kind of the official or standard view of Henry V. It even says, you know, about in the section you had in your packet, the opening part by the chorus is talking about how Henry went around through all the troops the night before the Battle of Agincourt, you know, encouraging them and so on. Well, in the actual play, he's in disguise. He's under the cloak of Sir Thomas Erpingham. They don't recognize him as the king, and he's going around kind of testing the morale of the troops. Far from, you know, spurring them up and encouraging them, he's kind of, you know, seeing how they're doing. So that, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that it's not quite the same as what the chorus is saying. That's my point. So the chorus on the first column of three. Now all the youth of England are on fire, and silken dalliance in the wardrobe lies. Now thrive the armorers, and honor's thought reigns solely in the breast of every man. They sell the pasture, now to buy the horse, following the mirror of all Christian kings, with winged heels as English Mercuries, and so on. The mirror of all Christian kings. So this is the kind of image that Henry V has that, you know, I think the English people accept, and that seems to be the one that the chorus itself is presenting to us. So, all right, you know, that seems to be the natural question here is whether he is in fact this ideal, or whether, you know, there's something else going on. And I think it's a complicated question. I don't think it's easy to answer. What is the effect that you think Hal wants to bring about when he does reform? What would you say is the effect he would most hope for? You put the crown on Henry V, the offending Adam is gone, right? There's an incredible transformation, unbelievable. So what does that say about the crown?
That's where it belongs.
It's where it belongs. It has, it bestows graces instantly upon him. And it's almost like the sword and the stone. Would it do so, right, if this were the wrong person? You know? So it's this effect of awe, of surprise, of, you know, re-legitimizing the crown itself. So he's not, all right, this is what I think is brilliant about it. He's no longer the son of Henry IV. He's kind of the son of Richard II, right? Or is he kind of the new Richard II? He's newly legitimated. He's cast off his dissolute past, right? His Richardly past, and reemerged, you know, through the crown into this new legitimacy that I want to call charismatic legitimacy. You see why? It's not the anointing, it's not the primogeniture, you know, coming through the oldest son. It's this somehow right to do it. Okay, so he becomes king. One of the first things he does is to reject Falstaff, which is an extremely painful scene. So Falstaff sees Henry going by, you know, in the procession. And, you know, here's his old buddy. And, you know, through the first two plays, you get used to these two. You know, they're insulting each other all the time, but it's so funny. And they're extremely witty, and, you know, Falstaff is always, you know, bloviating, and you know, Hal, you know, penetrates it, and they, you know, back and forth. So here's Henry as king. Falstaff comes up to him expecting to see. It's Falstaff. Anyway, Falstaff calls up to make his own right. So anyway, here's Falstaff thinking he's going to see his friend. He's going to get some kind of special blessing, some kind of, you know, old buddy from him. And instead what he gets is this cold, cold reaction. God save thee, my sweet boy. Henry, my Lord Chief Justice, speak to that vain man. Lord Chief Justice, have you your wits? Know you what 'tis you is to speak? My king, my Jove, I speak to thee, my heart. I know thee not, old man. Fall to thy prayers. How ill white hairs become a fool and jester. I have long dreamed of such a man, so surfeit swelled, so old, and so profane. But being awaked, I do despise my dream. And so on, right? This kind of icy rejection of Falstaff. There's nowhere in there, you know, for Falstaff to see a kind of nod to his old buddy, right? It says, if you ever see me acting like I did before, you can approach me then. But until then, stay away. Don't come within 10 miles of my person. For competence of life, I will allow you that lack of means enforce you not to evil, and so on. So what do we make of this? You see, I mean, this is one of those things in the play that's always hard to take. He doesn't take him aside and say, you know, I got to do this for the sake of public policy. Just cuts him off. It's part of the effect he's trying to achieve. Those evil companions of your youth, you have to reject. Well, it's sort of the offending Adam. It's almost like an embodiment, you know, of the old Adam, something like that, that he's casting off. Is that there's a movement in that Christian presentation from a formal kind of sacramental understanding of kingship to something else, and that Henry is the one who has to do that. He has to make that come about. Up to now, he's done it by calculation, right? I mean, I hope that's pretty clear. He's set up Falstaff and the others in order to be rejected so that he can emerge as this, you know, suddenly reformed Christian prince on whom the crown has bestowed these sudden graces. All right, so he needs two things now to really bring about what he needs to do as king. One thing is to restore England after the civil wars, restore unity to England. One of the best ways to restore people who are fighting against each other in your own country is a foreign war. And in fact, right at the end of Henry IV, part two, on his deathbed, his father said, "You need a foreign war. You need to go do this. That's the only way to pull people together." As soon as everybody has a common enemy, right, think about 9/11, all the civil discord goes away. How are you going to legitimately have a foreign war? Well, not to be cynical, but the archbishop and the bishop at the beginning of the play are worried about this proposal to seize on church lands and, you know, get revenues. So can't we think of a reason to attack France? Well, there's the Salic Law. So I'll let you read all that. Some productions of it making it to a real farce, you know, how they're doing their justification. Henry needs a reason to attack France. They give him one. He questions them extensively. Is this a just war? You know, think of all the people who might die in this war. And they assure him that it is. And so he proceeds against France. The other thing he needs is some truly powerful sign that he himself cannot bring about. He has, in a sense, calculated and manipulated the situation up to now, but is there a way in which he can be legitimated in such a way that he couldn't possibly have planned it himself? You see, that would be even more remarkable. I mean, it involves genuine risk. And so on. Okay, they attack France. They have a long siege at Harfleur, which he finally takes, but then he's trying to get back to Calais and get home to England. And his men are hungry and tired, and they get cut off by the French at Agincourt. They're outnumbered 5-1. And this is the scene which leads into the St. Crispin's Day speech. First, though, right, if he were truly Machiavellian, in the sense we've been saying, you know, using all this simply for political ends, would he make the prayer he does on page 3 in the second column?
O God of battles, steal my soldiers' hearts. Possess them not with fear. Take from them now the sense of reckoning if the opposing numbers pluck their hearts from them. Not today, O Lord. Oh, not today. Think not upon the fault my father made encompassing the crown. I, Richard's body, have interred anew, and on it have bestowed more contrite tears than from it issued forced drops of blood. 500 poor I have in yearly pay, who twice a day their withered hands hold up toward heaven to pardon blood. And I have built 2 chantries where the sad and solemn priests sing still for Richard's soul. More will I do, though all that I can do is nothing worth, since that my penitence comes from after all.
What does he mean at the last there? All I can do is nothing worth, since that my penitence comes after all, imploring pardon. What could he mean there? I mean, he has Richard on his conscience, right? He has all these people praying for Richard's soul. He's doing everything he can think of, you know, to undo the fault that his father committed in coming into the throne. Do y'all remember Hamlet? You remember there's a scene in Hamlet when Hamlet has a chance to kill Claudius. And he comes upon him, and Claudius is praying, right? And the thing that Claudius says at the end of his prayer is more or less this: how am I going to get forgiven for what I did when I still have all the benefits that came to me from doing it? You know, he's got the queen, he's got the crown. Unless he's willing to give those up, then how can he be, you know, how can he truly say that he's repentant? And is there something of that here?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, if none of that could do any good if Hal still has the kingship that came to him through his father. And that's where I think, this is what I think we're looking at in terms of the Battle of Agincourt. He needs some kind of new thing to happen, you know? Something that will legitimate him beyond anything that he's been able to do so far. Does that make sense? It will be a kind of new beginning. Comes the morning of the battle itself. Now, Father James, I know you know as I do that in the actual Battle of Agincourt, that battle was won not by Henry making a speech, but because of the English longbow and the longbowmen. As I recall, all the French cavalry and heavily armored knights got channeled into a very muddy space where all the advantages that they would have had otherwise were removed, and then the English longbowmen just head at them. The English longbow was an extraordinarily powerful bow. I mean, it was armor piercing, you know. It was at Crecy, you know, the French had first encountered it, and you know, in similar odds, I believe, and in similar outcome. It's, you know, it's about this tall, and these men that it's just like a regular bow, but it's just extraordinarily hard. I forget what the pounds on it. I think I may be totally exaggerating. You have to ask Graham Gates. I think it might have been like 300 pound draw.
Oh my God!
And these things.
We do know from burials that the archers.
They're huge. Right. Yeah, because
the pressure of all the muscular development.
They were doing this from their youth, you know, and so they were deformed looking. You know, they had this Beowulf arm. I mean Grendel. Excuse me, Grendel, not Beowulf. They were a scary group. So literally, you know, that's probably what won the Battle of Agincourt. Shakespeare, in this whole account, makes no mention whatsoever of bows, which brings us back, right, to this morning's play. In other words, no bow. So the whole emphasis of Shakespeare is on the speech that Henry V gives. All right, so let's read the St. Crispin's Day speech. I'm not going to try to read it. Who wants to volunteer? Okay, I'll do Westmoreland. How about that?
All right, go.
Oh, that we now had here but 1/10,000 of those men in England that do no work today.
What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? No, my fair cousin. If we are marked to die, we are now to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honor. God's will. I pray thee, wish not one man more. By Jove, I am not covetous for gold, nor care I who doth feed upon my cost. It yearns me not if men my garments wear. Such outward things dwell not in my desires. But if it be a sin to covet honor, I am the most offending soul alive. No, faith, my cousin, wish not a man from England. God's peace. I would not lose so great an honor as one man before me thinks would share from me for the best hope I have. Oh, do not wish one more. Rather proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when the day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispian. Then he will strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son. And Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
Beautifully done. Thank you. Okay, I hate to ask questions, but what is the, I mean, if we have to analyze it, what is the appeal of this speech? Everybody feels it, right? Feel it right away. It's almost like the music Stan was playing. What's the dominant emotion that's being evoked here?
It's predicting that great things are going to happen.
Yeah.
Without obviously having much promise of that.
Right. I mean, they're severely outnumbered, right? And this, which is why Westmoreland says, God, if we just had a few of the people that are in England not doing anything today, would help our cause. And, you know, Henry, don't, not a one, right?
They're going to wish they were here.
They're going to wish they were here, right? We don't want them here, right? In fact,
hope is the dominant emotion. It's from that hope that the courage, which is evident, is flowing.
Yeah.
The hope more explicitly fastens on the greatness.
And he's making
Christ.
Them his brothers.
Yeah.
He's telling them, you're my equal if you make it through this day. He says, for today, that he that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile. This day shall gentle his condition.
Yeah.
So he makes them Englishmen.
But he doesn't really say, we're going to win, y'all.
Right.
He says,
no.
We're going to bleed today, and ellipsis.
Yeah. Right.
Like, we could go one way, it could go the other. But regardless, there's glory to be had here today because of our...
But he also.
How hard we're going to fight.
Yeah, but he makes them all old men, right? Sitting in the taverns, which he's very familiar with, right? Thinking about, oh man, remember St. Crispin's Day, right? Look at that. That's the scar I got, you know, on St. Crispin's Day. So he makes them survive it by decades, right? And look. Yeah, and now they look back on this day, which they haven't yet begun to enter into, as though it were already a memory, you know, held sacred by, you know, it's just a sort of astonishing feat he pulls off here. And he doesn't want anybody there who doesn't want to fight, right? If you don't want to do this, head on out. All right, what about the business with honor? If we ascend to covet honor and the most offending soul alive, I mean, when we read it, we're good with honor. But if we're Antony of Egypt, we're not, you know. What about honor as a shareable thing? Let me give you a counterexample. When Achilles sends Patroclus out to fight wearing his armor, he says, now go get him out of the camp, you know, get him away from the ships. Drive them out and then come back. Because if you do too much, you're going to take away my honor. So honor is a kind of, what's the economic term? Maybe it's finite.
Commodity.
It's a commodity.
It's not fungible.
Right. So, you know, you can't, you start cutting honor up into all these pieces, that means less for everybody, which is exactly his argument. The fewer men we have here, the more honor for each. You know, if we had to share honor with 15,000 guys, you know, there wouldn't be that much, but the few of us, we happy few, right? We're the ones who get to participate in this. So the appeal to honor, the gentling of their condition, I don't care who you are, right? If you're here fighting in this battle, we are a band of brothers. There's no hierarchy, there's no class division. You know, by the time he gets to the end of the speech, what do we say here about the relation between speech and courage? It's hard to read this speech, even, you know, sitting in your room and not feel more courageous than you did before you were reading the speech, right? So what is that? It's got something to do with honor, right? And the appeal of honor, which may be have something to do with the beautiful, right? It's hard to imagine saying, geez, I don't know. Sure are a lot of Frenchmen up there, you know? Right. He brings it about in them through his speech, right? Through what he's able to enable them to imagine and participate in, right? Look back on as though they had already survived the battle, which, you know, may in fact kill them. Churchill was a great student of this speech. Let me prove it. This is his speech on June 18, 1940, shortly after Dunkirk, when he's anticipating the Nazi attack on England. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour. Right? So, you know, into the future, looking back, praised by the generations that follow. I mean, it just gets your spine. Anyway, let's look on page 5, sort of in the aftermath of this. Henry's given the paper, sort of the tally after the battle.
This note doth tell me of 10,000 French that in the field lie slain. Of princes in this number and nobles bearing banners, there lie dead 126. Added to these, of knights, esquires, and gallant gentlemen, 8,400, of the which 500 were but yesterday dubbed knights, so that in these 10,000 they have lost, there are but 1,600 mercenaries. The rest are princes, barons, lords, knights, squires, and gentlemen of blood and quality. Where is the number of officers dead? Edward, the Duke of York, the Earl of Suffolk, Sir Richard Ketley, David Gamm, Esquire, none else of name, and of all other men, but 25. O God, thy arm was here, and not to us, but to thy arm alone ascribe we all. When, without stratagem, but in plain shock and even play of battle, was ever known so great and little loss on one part and on the other. Take it, God, for it is none but thine.
Okay, and notice his next speech, right? Come, go in procession to the village, and be it death proclaimed throughout our host, to boast of this or take the praise from God, which is his only. Mm-hmm. What do we make of this? He doesn't make an appeal to piety before the battle, right? I mean, let me just make the point and leave it there. He doesn't say before the battle, we English are in the right. You know, God is on our side. And we're about to show the French, you know, that we are the holy side in this conflict. But after the fact, right, when he sees the disproportionate, astonishingly disproportionate loss on the French side and on the English side, he's no longer talking about sharing honor, right, among the men. In fact, if anybody boasts, if anybody says anything, you know, against the fact that this was God's deed, death. So this is the kind of, you know, new baptism, or however you talk about it, the charismatic laying on of kingship that is as clear a sign as it could be. How could they possibly have won with this kind of, against these odds and in this fashion, unless it had been God's work on their side? We can attribute it to the speech, and certainly that the speech gave them courage, but is this part of his calculation?
I think that this is, if we do read it, that he has been making calculations all along, in the end, the person he needs to convince the most in the face of all of that is himself. He needs a sign from God, not only as a sign to the nation, but it's a sign to himself that he is legitimate.
Right. Because he knows what he's done, right?
Yes.
And that's what I meant when I said he needs something that is indisputably not his own calculation. That's beautifully said. It's got to convince him. And this, seems to do that, right? So they march off singing Non Nobis and Te Deum, and then to Calais, and then back to England. But, complicated set of circumstances, but I think it seems to me that it's Shakespeare working through the whole question of Machiavellian princeliness and saying, maybe up to a point you can do that, but it's not gonna bear you to the place you want to be unless there's really some support from powers outside yourself. This is Shakespeare. He's never going to be without complexity. Anything you get where it shows the glory of God is also going to show the human machinations that are going into all this. So, it's never just the glory of God, right? And it's never just the machinations of men, but, this kind of thing true to both that seems to be what really distinguishes Shakespeare. See, I would say that Prince Hal does a fake prodigal son, But then he can't do this one, right? He can inspire the men, but you can't guarantee that against 5-1 odds you're gonna win. So it really does feel like a deliverance, some sort of passage. Okay, thank you.